when the a magazine offered $500,000 to for the first person to be able to ride a verified 100-foot wave, it sent its own kind of shockwaves out into the community, and everybody was scrambling to be able to do it. What were their biggest challenges to be able to win that $500,000?
Well, nobody to date has really gotten the sort of like the official nod as the man who surfed the 100-foot wave. You know, finding it is the biggest challenge. The rogue waves that take out ships and the tsunamis that, you know, rewrite the maps, those are themselves, you know, anomalous waves. And these waves, the waves that are, that come along that are that big but that are somehow rideable, they're not avalanches of stormy, choppy water. They're rideable waves that have been spun off from very, very big storms and have been created by features in the ocean, like really deep water reefs, or in one case, a very spooky case off the coast of California, a sunken underwater mountain range. These waves, you know, the surfers monitor these storms, and it's a small group of men who want to do this kind of like extreme surfing. It's not like the average person who's got their surfboard and is headed down, as he said, to the beach. And they, you know, the biggest challenge for them to find these waves is the storms that create them and the perfect wind conditions and everything else. It's like waiting for all the cherries to line up on the slot machine.
Right.
It doesn't happen that often, and they have to be on it when it does. And they also have to be interpretive. They almost have to be like closet meteorologists and oceanographers to be able to find these things. And then, as I call it in the book, it's really a global scavenger hunt. It's like, you know, to get in the right place and to have jet skis and photographers and everything else, it's quite an undertaking.
Okay, but you jumped ahead of yourself there, because then, I mean, after first the idea, the first challenge was trying to be able to find them. But the second challenge is once you found them, then what? And that's where the jet ski thing came into it.
Right, right. The average, like the human body, the way that it works and paddling into a wave as surfers do, it stops at about 40, 50 feet. You can't do it when the wave is any bigger than that. It's like, as I said in the book, trying to catch the subway by crawling, or, you know, trying to merge onto the highway on your bicycle. It's just not going, you're not going fast enough. So Laird Hamilton, who's one of the central characters in the wave, and his friends in Maui, you know, a group of guys, they had sort of been watching these bigger waves off the coast of Maui, these 60, 70, 80 foot waves, and trying to figure out how can we ride them. Like, the best waves in the world are going unridden. And they created this technique called tow surfing that uses jet skis and water ski tow ropes and a very redesigned surfboard, a smaller, sleeker, but with foot straps on it, almost like a snowboard, but a very spearish-looking sort of snowboard, heavy but smaller. And theoretically, they can use this technique to ride a wave of any size.
Well, that was it. They had to find somebody then that not only, I mean, maybe it was easy enough to find somebody that's willing to try to surf it, but you had to find somebody else that's willing to try to ride a jet ski up it and then get out of there in time, because there's only a little window before when they have to get out of that wave.
Yeah, that partnership is critical. You know, that's like your partner is willing to put their life on the line for you, and you have to be willing to put your life on the line for your partner. Laird Hamilton and Dave Kalama are the really dominant partnership in this sport. I mean, it's a sport they created themselves, and they literally will go in to any sort of life-threatening conditions to rescue one another, and in fact, to rescue other surfers that they may not even know. But, you know, the sport has a kind of built-in camaraderie and a built-in crisis management because they're all sort of looking out for one another in these very extreme conditions that they're in.
What's at stake if they get it wrong?
Well, you know, one of the questions that I set out to answer in the book was, what happens if you fall on a 70-foot wave? And, you know, how does anybody survive that? And what I learned is that, you know, they can survive it. You can get lucky or unlucky. And if the lip hits you, you know, where the wave is crashing down, that can be extremely bad. And, you know, it parts the water like a axe. So you can hit the bottom. And when you hit the bottom, that's when the real trouble happens, or if you hit a reef. But, you know, when they don't hit the bottom, other really pretty harrowing things can happen. I mean, they can be held down there for quite a long time. And what I consider, you know, the best explanation of it is an underwater bomb blast. And they, you know, Dave Kalama said to me, you know, you tuck in your limbs, you try to protect your neck, but really you have to relax, because no matter what you do, you're not going to fight this force. And the idea of relaxing in the dark, 30 feet under the water, in an underwater bomb blast with your eardrums potentially blown out because you've been driven down. So, I mean, it's like every human fear rolled up into one experience. So I was very curious about it. And a lot of tow servers had such dramatically, you know, terrible experiences falling that they quit. And in the course of writing The Wave, I follow a group that goes out on a day that really killed several people. And they all you know, have their own experiences, but their lives are hanging by a thread, and some of them end up ending their careers that day. They never go back again.